way he could ever pay back the advance. Once again, his money situation was dire. His experience running the Edwards campaign had offered a possible fix. By telling the story of his efforts in small-town participatory democracy, he might be able to provide a through line on the disparate set pieces documenting recent national disasters. But for that to work, he told Salter, he'd need to see the process through. In the upcoming November elections, he decided to run for sheriff of Pitkin County, which would only delay the book further. In the meantime, he was desperate for well-paying journalistic assignments. He had a new magazine in mind, Scanlon's Monthly, which was run by his friend Warren Hinkle. The problem was finding the ideal topic to write about next. James Salter listened attentively. He was 44, hale and unassuming, and without haste. Across from Thompson, he held himself with the posture of an elite athlete, that of a rock climber or a swimmer, his carriage a carryover from his previous career in the Air Force, during the course of which he'd flown more than 100 combat missions. In Korea, he'd been a member of the 335th Squadron, damaging one enemy jet and shooting down another. While still on active duty, he'd published a novel about the war, The Hunters, that became such a critical and financial success that he gave up his commission to write full-time. Over the course of his literary career, he'd enjoyed a series of successes and also stinging failures, and he understood the despair and frustration and desire for recognition, for greatness, that his younger friend was talking about. The idea that your work, in a certain sense, was you. On the whole, James Salter enjoyed Thompson's writing. At the end of the night, he had a suggestion. What about going back to Louisville and doing something on the Kentucky Derby? The notion hadn't occurred to Hunter Thompson, but it made sense. Later, back at Owl Farm, he called up Hinkle in San Francisco, who quickly got on board. And just like that, it was happening. The magazine could pay $1,500 plus $500 for expenses, including plane tickets that Hinkle FedExed the next day to Woody Creek. The deadline to meet the June issue was fast approaching. Everything would have to be finished the week after the race. Hinkle also agreed to send out an illustrator to provide artwork for the feature, a political sketch artist for the London-based magazine Private Eye, Ralph Steadman. The story, as I see it, Thompson said after the dinner at Salter's, is mainly in the vicious, drunk, southern bourbon horseshit mentality that surrounds the Derby rather than the Derby itself. He arrived in Louisville on Thursday around midnight, April 30. A few hours earlier, Richard Nixon had gone on national television to explain a startling escalation in the Vietnam War, the U.S.-backed offensive into Cambodia. "I have concluded that the time has come for action," Nixon said. "My fellow Americans, we live in an age of anarchy, both abroad and at home." Nobody had expected it. Only 10 days earlier, the president had announced a drawdown of 150,000 troops, and a wave of protests broke out at colleges across the country. Finding himself in his hometown of Louisville again under such circumstances, a weekend featuring both the Derby and mass turmoil over the continuing war in Southeast Asia, Thompson was appalled. Everywhere he looked, at the airport, at his hotel, at Churchill Downs and its riotous paddock bar, he saw people who physically embodied the nation's Nixon-Agnew mentality. The sort of Americans who, on the whole, thought the protesters at the DNC had gone too far, who couldn't understand why certain groups in our society felt so disadvantaged, who, in their incuriousness and acquiescence, gave voice to the percentage of the population willing to, without any sense of hypocrisy, support felony charges for something like marijuana possession as they proceeded to drink and gamble themselves into a lifelong stupor of mainstream vices, and who, when it came to the national unrest over the war, didn't hesitate to blame the violence on the victims of the attacks. In short, what Thompson had seen in Chicago was just the latest expression of the injustice he'd grown up with here during the 1940s and 50s in Jim Crow era Louisville. What he called the mask of the whiskey gentry, a pretentious mix of booze, failed dreams, and a terminal identity crisis. As a senior in high school 15 years earlier, he'd barely escaped this city, enlisting in the Air Force as a way out. And this was only after he'd spent 30 days in the county lockup. He and two other friends had been accused of robbing four teenagers. This was during a confrontation at one of the bluffs overlooking the river. But his friends, the sons of wealthy attorneys, had connections to the judge. In the end, Thompson was the only one who actually went to jail. "Returning to the scenes of my youth," he'd write to Hinkle after the race, "was not, all in all, an exceptionally wise idea." The next day, Friday, May 1, still 24 hours from the start of the race, he headed to the track so he could meet his fellow Scanlan's correspondent, Ralph Steadman. They finally found each other in the Derby's press box. "This is a weird place," Thompson said to him. "Why don't we grab a few beers and maybe talk things over?" Steadman was a talented 33-year-old Welsh illustrator whose general aesthetic was one of comic exaggeration. With his tweed jacket and thick beard, he'd been struggling ever since he landed in Kentucky to acclimate himself, which fit well with Thompson's own rage-tinged discombobulation at returning home. And for the next 3 days, as America undid itself with a final paroxysm of Vietnam War protests and dissent and lethal violence, these two interlopers, in tandem with thousands of Southern celebrants, got uproariously drunk. They spent Saturday at Churchill Downs. They toured the infield and its madness. They drank for free in the press section. At race time, they took up their allotted positions just beneath the governor's box. Barry Goldwater and other prominent politicians were there, along with local dignitaries like Colonel Sanders. And during the race itself, which only lasted 2 minutes, they watched everyone in the grandstand watching the horses. "We'd come there to watch the real beasts perform," Thompson would write. Later that night, they hit up the Pendennis Club, an old Southern venue, but almost immediately they were kicked out. Steadman had gotten too friendly with one of the members' wives. Sunday, it was the same, a human sea of mud and alcohol and revulsion and anger as they hopped from bar to bar. At one point, a can of mace may have been used. By Monday, as the university protests continued to escalate, Ralph Steadman finally left Louisville. Thompson stayed another night. While still back in his hometown, he heard, disbelievingly, about the massacre that had occurred that afternoon on the campus of Kent State University. Four students had been murdered by National Guardsmen, who'd fired repeatedly into the unarmed crowd of 500 anti-war protesters. Afterward, he flew up to New York, where, at the Royalton Hotel, located near Times Square, a block from Scanlan's East Coast office, he hunkered down in his dilapidated suite and began the process of transforming his notes into the article. He stayed in the city until Sunday, his deadline. That week, Richard Nixon said, "When dissent turns to violence, it invites tragedy." Spiro Agnew, the administration's attack dog for all matters concerning civil liberties, anti-war demonstrations, and press freedom, referred to the protesters as exhibitionists who provoke more derision than fear, and suggested that they'd incited the tragedy, which he called predictable and avoidable. A day later, both the president and vice president were reprimanded by their own Secretary of the Interior in an astonishing open letter that concluded, "Youth in its protest must be heard." Hundreds of campuses were closed. In Iowa City, students broke into the old Capitol building and set fires. In Madison, Wisconsin, homemade bombs were thrown into empty classrooms. The National Guard used tear gas at Southern Illinois and Kentucky and West Virginia. In all, 4 million students went on strike to protest the war. On Friday, at Broad and Wall Street, About 6 miles from Hunter Thompson's Manhattan suite, hundreds of construction workers chanting, "All the way, USA," attacked a crowd of anti-war demonstrators. Afterward, they marched to City Hall, where they forcibly raised the American flag, which had been lowered to half-staff in honor of the Kent State victims. On May 14, at Jackson State in Mississippi, guardsmen would open fire again, killing 2 more students. Working in his suite, Thompson was initially able to construct set pieces from his collected notes. But by the end of the week, as New York City was hit by a startling heat wave and as the country deteriorated into all-out conflict over the war, he retreated to the Royalton's bathtub, where, with a quart of scotch and his usual supply of Dexedrin, he resorted to finishing the article by hand. In the end, the timing got so tight that he found himself inserting his original notes directly into the draft. On Sunday night, he and managing editor Don Goddard were able to compile a chronological draft and then cut 4,000 additional words, digressions on the deeply Nixon-Agnew-esque character of Louisville society and on his own experience growing up there. And then they sent their draft of the feature to Hinkle in San Francisco, who, after cutting a few more pages and inserting a series of organizational headers, the view from Thompson's head, a huge outdoor loony bin, etc., delivered it with Ralph Steadman's artwork to the printer, just hours before the deadline. The Kentucky Derby is Decadent and Depraved came out in June. For Hunter Thompson, the whole thing felt like a compromise, an unfinished draft, a failure. "I wish there'd been time to do it better," he wrote to Hinkle when he saw the galleys. "With another week, I might have honed it down to a finer, meatier edge." To Steadman, the article is useless, except for the flashes of style and tone it captures. "But I suspect you and I are the only ones who can really appreciate it." To Bill Cardoso, "It's a shitty article, a classic of irresponsible journalism. Horrible way to write anything." But as soon as the issue came out, Thompson started getting phone calls and letters from friends and colleagues. Tom Wolfe said that it was the funniest thing he'd ever read. William Kennedy told him it was a formal breakthrough, part reportage, part memoir, part exaggeration / fiction. And Cardoso sent a note of encouragement. "Hunter, I don't know what the fuck you're doing, but you've changed everything. It's totally gonzo." At the start of the piece, Thompson alluded to the new wave of unrest while he flipped through the Courier Journal at an airport newsstand. And in the final scene, the first reports of the massacre at Kent State were coming over through the car radio. But all of the direct cultural analysis was cut out of the final draft. Instead, the scenes themselves would serve to make his political point. By focusing on the experiences that he and Steadman endured over the course of the weekend instead of the actual race, he managed to indict the perspectives of the people around him by taking on their behavior as his own, which allowed him to criticize them by criticizing himself, a much more effective line of attack. "My eyes had finally opened enough for me to look in the mirror across the room," he wrote in the last section. "And I was stunned at the shock of recognition. There he was, by God, a puffy, drink-ravaged, disease-ridden caricature, like an awful cartoon version. It was the face we'd been looking for, and it was, of course, my own." By the final paragraph, the transformation was complete. Thompson had turned himself into a cartoonish version of the cops who'd beaten and maced him in Chicago. "The journalist rams the big car through traffic and into a spot in front of the terminal. Then he reaches over to open the door on the passenger's side and shoves the Englishman out, snarling, 'Bug off, you worthless faggot, you twisted pig fucker.' Crazed laughter. 'If I weren't sick, I'd kick your ass all the way to Bowling Green, you scum-sucking foreign geek. Mace is too good for you. We can do without your kind in Kentucky.'" In the end, the article itself, composed in a New York bathtub, As America descended into a horrific replay of the last decade's conflict, worked like a grotesque mirror on a country willing to beat and shoot and send off to war to sacrifice its own children, a symbol of the whole doomed atavistic culture. The original June 1970 issue of Scanlan's ended on a short author's note. Hunter Thompson has gone back home to rest in Aspen, Colorado, where he edits the Aspen wall poster and is threatening to become a candidate for sheriff of that community. All their foul hopes and greedy fascist dreams. That fall, for the first debate in the 1970 race for sheriff of Pitkin County, Hunter S. Thompson appeared at Snowmass's Opticon Theater wearing a multicolored L.L. Bean shooting jacket and dark Levi's jeans. He was smoking a Dunhill cigarette from his plastic Targard mouthpiece. Around his neck hung a silver Aztec medallion, a recent gift from Oscar Acosta. Once again, it was meant as a talisman. On his head, he sported a floppy, white-brimmed tennis hat. Earlier in the day, with the help of Billy Noonan, he'd shaved his scalp, a move that now allowed him the opportunity to describe the other person up on stage, the county's current sheriff, clean-cut Carol Whitmire, as my long-haired opponent. It was Monday, October 12th. Over 300 people had turned out, a packed house. Things kicked off with the flip of a coin. Each candidate would give a short presentation, and then the proceedings would turn to the floor, to the audience members who'd prepared written questions. Whitmire won the toss. He chose to go second. Thompson, sitting next to him, leaned into the microphone. "The power of the office," he said, "could be used to good effect, to help improve quality of life, to help slow development, fight pollution, and check on consumer fraud. But to do so," he explained, "it was imperative to change county government for those of us who want to live here, to keep the place from being sold out from under us," which got at the central issue of his campaign. For Aspen to retain its identity, it would need to embrace a public discourse, the politics of openness and transparency, as opposed to what he'd been referring to throughout his campaign as private politics, the old politics, those of secrecy and deals made behind closed doors for the interests of the few. Old politics only benefited the valley's powerful developers, the greed heads and land rapers, who'd sell out the town until there was nothing left to take. Across the country, it was the same. The recent triumph of old politics in Chicago and Washington, D.C., threatened the very premise of the American system. On every side, from coast to coast, on the TV news and 1,000 daily newspapers, we have blown it. That fantastic possibility that Abe Lincoln called the last best hope of man. New politics, as Thompson had recently explained in his campaign newsletters, was premised on accountability. The essence of democracy is that the people are the power base of their government. His own interpretation of this approach was called freak power, a concept he'd been exploring since the first issue of his wall posters. "This is the real point, that we are not really freaks at all, not in the literal sense, but the twisted realities of the world we are trying to live in have somehow combined to make us feel like freaks. We argue, we protest, we petition, nothing changes. So now, with the rest of the nation erupting in a firestorm of bombings and political killings, a handful of freaks are running a final, perhaps atavistic experiment with the idea of forcing change by voting. And if that has to be called freak power, well, whatever's right." That autumn afternoon at the Opticon, to conclude his opening statement, Hunter Thompson said, "I'm here to prove to the disenchanted, the freaks, that the political processes still work." Sitting alongside, Carol Whitmire glanced out at the enormous crowd, his eyes glistening with disbelief. He was 38 years old, dressed in a dark suit and patterned tie. When he finally spoke, it was in a drawl. "I know about writing citations," he explained during his opening statement. "About accidents in the middle of the night. Accidents in the mountains." He swallowed loudly. "I want the job real bad." The general format for both sheriff debates that October centered around a straightforward question-and-answer format. The race was actually a three-way affair, but the Republican candidate, Glenn Ricks, had skipped the first event. "Due to the fact that this meeting has apparently been turned into a three-ring circus," he denounced, "I cannot condone it with my appearance." The general consensus in town was that Thompson would put on a show, that he was unserious, and that the whole thing was a publicity stunt. He'd suggested as much himself. "I'd really prefer not to win," he'd told the Los Angeles Times at the start of the month. "In the end, I may make my program so outrageous that I won't get any votes." But once the debates kicked off, it was clear that Hunter Thompson planned to run a serious, thoughtful, well-prepared campaign, which shouldn't have come as all that much of a shock to people who knew him well. As Peggy Clifford would later remark about his candidacy, he had never had any talent for remaining aloof. In his response to one of the earliest questions, when challenged to enumerate on the duties that a position like sheriff should entail, he pulled out and read from a copy of the Colorado Revised Statutes. Moments later, Carol Whitmire was asked if lawmen should carry a gun. "I have only pulled my gun one time in 9 years," the incumbent replied. "But when I need a gun, I want it there." Immediately, Thompson turned this statement around. If a law enforcement officer had only needed to draw his firearm once a decade, wasn't that proof in itself that the opposite was true? "I see a sheriff as a person who can help people as well as bring people to justice," he explained. "Not arming police would be a worthwhile experiment and worth trying. If it didn't work, officers could be armed again." All in all, he responded in detail to the questions posed to him over the course of the two debates, which were held that October on the 12th and 24th. Moderator: "Why are you running for sheriff?" Hunter S. Thompson: "We either have a participating democracy or a police state. The only power we have is the vote. This is the last time, perhaps, where freaks may obtain control. Democracy is not working in the rest of the country. The war goes on. No progress on civil rights. But we can make it work here." Moderator: "What will you do about users of hard narcotics?" Hunter S. Thompson: "Junkies are bad people to deal with. They make all our lives harder. I don't like needle-injected drugs. I'm dead against them. Any heroin and speed dealers will be advised by this community that they must quit or get out of town." Moderator: "Do you think mere possession of marijuana, first offense, should be a felony?" Hunter S. Thompson: "Absolutely not. The current laws were passed in 1935, during a time of mass hysteria and total ignorance about marijuana. The single law has made felons out of an entire generation of people and has widened the generation gap to a chasm. It's time that we either bridge that chasm with some kind of realistic law enforcement, or else I don't think it's going to be bridged in this country. We're going to get a revolution." Moderator: "Where do you plan to put your major effort if elected?" Hunter S. Thompson: "I plan to expand the scope of the sheriff's office to encompass the prevention and elimination of the causes of crime, as well as merely dealing with the effects of it after the fact. I intend to hire a competent undersheriff to handle the job of sheriff, as it has been conventionally regarded. I have an identifiable communication with the kids that no ordinary law enforcement officer would have. As mentioned before, the younger generation regards the police as the enemy. I would use this line of communication to be a sociologist-type ombudsman." Moderator: "What is a freak?" Hunter S. Thompson: "The way things are going in this country today, it's a very honorable designation, and I'm proud of it. To be abnormal, to deviate from the style of government that I deplore in America today, is not only wise, but necessary." Following the debates, In the wake of a new voter registration push that appeared to net an additional 700 possible supporters for the Freak Power ticket, the residents of Aspen who stood to lose the most from a Hunter Thompson victory started to panic. "If he was elected sheriff," Whitmire said to a British film crew in town to cover the election, "it would actually destroy Aspen." Carol Denver Whitmire had been born in 1931 in Stillwater, Oklahoma. Afterward, in the wake of the economic and ecological catastrophe, the Great Depression, the Dust Bowl, his family moved to western Colorado. Before he could finish the ninth grade, he dropped out of school. He never went back. 15 years later, he showed up in Aspen, where he took a position in the sheriff's department and was promoted to deputy. Eventually, he challenged and defeated the county's elderly incumbent, Lorraine Herwick. "Real lawmen are in the business because they like it," he said during the debates, "not for the money." From the voiceover to his 1970 campaign ad, "The American sheriff's job was carved out of the rugged West. It was a desperately needed position of few words, much action, little praise, and little glory. It takes a man who knows his people and their laws and wants to be a sheriff of Pitkin County." For Carol D. Whitmire, someone whose family had migrated west along with millions of others in search of a reprieve, getting elected head constable was, by all accounts, a lifetime achievement. He'd become sheriff in 1966, and his first term happened to coincide with a fresh influx of migration to the county seat, a bracing wave of countercultural young men and women from California that nothing in Whitmire's personal and professional experience had prepared him to handle. For his entire adult life, he'd worked in and around the Continental Divide. He had 8 children. He lived with his family in the basement of the Aspen Courthouse. His wife was also named Carol. At local parades, he would often be seen riding a horse. He once deputized John Wayne, a frequent guest at the Jerome. And in response to the cultural upheaval that since the Summer of Love had continued to spread throughout the Roaring Fork River Valley, Carol Whitmire felt, in a word, besieged. Back at the start of the summer, he claimed at a conference in Denver that he'd been receiving a series of alarming reports from the Colorado Bureau of Investigation. Outside agitators were plotting to attack the valley in the run-up to the election. What's more, such provocateurs were already here, posing as locals to overtake the town's institutions and attack its leaders, a list of targets on which he himself had been included. Not that these reports ever appeared to have any basis in fact. Still, after everything he'd seen in the past 4 years, both nationally and at the local level, they must have made a certain amount of unpleasant sense. Something was happening. And for him, the best way to explain it was with the same logic that national law enforcement entities like the FBI had been relying on for years. America was being infiltrated by its foreign adversaries, their ideas, materiel, and manpower, by ruthless, unceasing enemies whose ultimate goal was to burrow into the deepest ranks of pre-existing leftist organizations to destroy the fabric of society itself. Hunter Thompson had learned about Whitmire's growing paranoia from a friend in the state's Democratic caucus, and that June he headlined his wall poster number 4 with the article, "Aspen's Summer of Hate, 1970. Will the Sheriff Be Killed?" "The plot, according to Whitmire," Thompson wrote, "was for a full-scale invasion of the town. Several thousand drug-crazed motorcycle thugs, led by the Hell's Angels, would make a twin-pincer frontal assault, while at the same moment, the town would be blasted and terrorized by well-trained demo teams of Black Panthers and weathermen." It was satirical, the same rhetorical device he'd employed in his essay on the Derby. He exaggerated the threat against the sheriff to punctuate the absurdity of the logic. Beneath the article, a Tom Benton graphic read, "Today's pig is tomorrow's bacon." In the final paragraph, Thompson concluded, With his job on the line and his public image sagging, a crisis atmosphere might be just the gimmick he needs to get back in the limelight. Keep in mind that 1970 is an election year. The thing about satire, however, is that by using it effectively, you're pretty much setting yourself up for a fight no matter what. The people against you who get it, who understand what you're calling them out on, also recognize how successful the tool can be when it comes to exposing the true nature of their intentions, which usually causes them to then raise the stakes. On the flip side, the remaining opponents, the simplest of your adversaries, those officials over whose heads the whole sardonic gesture is bound to fly, now tend to react in turn with an unabashed degree of horror and terror and ruthless self-defense. They can't help but perceive at face value the threats you'd simply meant as comic exaggerations. In this sense, Carol Whitmire, the region's predictable basement-dwelling lawman, was at best a tool, a dangerous one to be sure, who from the start was being manipulated by the people who had the most to gain from the town's continued mass development. There was Guido Meyer, the monomaniacal Swiss hotelier who hated hippies so much he'd actually packed his children off to boarding school in Europe. It was only after Richard Nixon had finally won the presidency, restoring his faith in the viability of the country's future, that he allowed his son and daughter to return to America. Also, Dr. J. Sterling Baxter, a crude local version of Lyndon Johnson, who fellow freak power candidate Ned Vair was challenging for the county commissioner position, and recently elected Mayor Eve Hohmeyer, who earlier that spring told the Denver Post, "Aspen is going to become a place for a second vacation rather than a way of life." To counter, Hunter Thompson had put together his own group of talented local citizens. His campaign manager was Michael Solheim, the owner of the Invisible Line, an interior decorating outfit that specialized in Victorian painting and wallpapering. Ed Bastian, a former University of Iowa basketball player and staff member on the Nelson Rockefeller and George Romney 1968 presidential bids, served as the main event and strategy coordinator. In her column for the Aspen Times, Peggy Clifford wrote just before the election, "Old-style Big Daddy politics have not worked in Pitkin County. I think it's time we try something else." And James Salter produced and narrated the main radio advertisement, which was set against the jazz flute overture of Herbie Mann's The Battle Hymn of the Republic. Hunter Thompson is a moralist posing as an immoralist. Nixon is an immoralist disguised as a moralist. This is James Salter. There'll be thieves and auto wrecks in Aspen whoever gets elected. But Hunter represents something wholly alien to the other candidates for sheriff, ideas, and sympathy toward the young, generous, grass-oriented society which is making the only serious effort to face the technological nightmare we have created. The only thing against him is that he is a visionary. He wants too pure a world. 13 days before the election, on a Wednesday afternoon in downtown Aspen, a man wearing a motorcycle jacket with what appeared to be the insignia of a winged death's head on the back walked into the bar located beneath the Wheeler Opera House. He introduced himself as Jim Bromley. He was in his 20s, bearded and muscular. "I'll take a double bourbon," he said. When it arrived, he pulled out a switchblade. Flicking open the knife, he slowly stirred his drink.
"I'm a friend of Hunter Thompson. Anyone know where I can find him?"
A few hours later, Bromley roared up to Woody Creek Road on his bike and peeled to a stop in front of Owl Farm. To Thompson, he shouted that he'd been sent by Sonny Barger. He was in town to deliver a message. "Your fucking house will be blown up and you'll be fucking killed if you win the election." And then he turned around and sped off. The first thing Thompson had noticed was Bromley's motorcycle. It was a Harley Davidson, but no genuine outlaw biker would ever be caught dead on it. A bike that didn't bear any resemblance to the classic Angels chopped hog style. If this stranger had been for real, his Harley would have been stripped down to its essentials. which meant that Bromley was most likely an undercover agent or some other sort of provocateur. Thompson didn't consider dropping out of the race. 3 days later, after the second debate, in which Carol Whitmire's most coherent statements all had to do with how badly he wanted the job, Jim Bromley showed up at Thompson's campaign headquarters, located in Parlor B of the Jerome Hotel. He claimed that he'd talked to Sonny again. Now things had changed. Bromley wanted to help the campaign in any way he could. He offered to make copies and send out mass mailers. He asked if he could join on as Thompson's bodyguard, at no cost to the candidate. And then, to a clearly uncomfortable audience that included Bastion and Solheim, and also Oscar Zeta Acosta, in town on his way back from Denver, where he'd been representing the Chicano activist Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez, Bromley suggested that the best thing for them to do was gather a posse together and kick the shit out of Sheriff Whitmire and anyone else stupid enough to get in the way of their freak power ticket. "We'll kill them," he said. "There will be blood on the streets up to our ankles." At one point, he even mentioned that he happened to be selling, at a decent price, guns and explosives. Thompson's campaign had already contacted the district attorney and filed a formal complaint, but so far they hadn't heard back. That Sunday night, Acosta, who earlier in the summer had also run for sheriff of Los Angeles County, coming in second, sat down with Bastion and Thompson at the Jerome Bar for an hours-long strategy session. Afterward, they were walking out of the hotel when a friend on the Aspen police force, Rick Crabtree, a former English major at Columbia, stopped them and said, "Hey, you guys should know, that guy that's been hanging around your office? Well, we found a car on Main Street parked in a place it shouldn't have been, and we towed it in and opened up the trunk and found a trunkload of automatic weapons. We found out where the guy is staying and went to his motel and brought him in for questioning, at which point he showed us his identification as an ATF agent and says, 'You can't arrest me, I'm here on federal business.'" Crabtree had taken as evidence a pump-action 20-gauge sawed-off shotgun, but a deputy from the sheriff's department had summarily returned it to Bromley. So, on Monday afternoon, October 26th, the election just over a week away, Thompson and Solheim scheduled a meeting in Joe Edwards's law office with the sheriff and his campaign manager. The assistant DA was there, too. Hunter Thompson jumped right in. He told his opponent he knew what was going on. Bromley was an undercover federal agent who'd threatened to kill political candidates. What's more, he'd been brought out to Aspen by the town's current sheriff to interfere in the democratic process. By now, Thompson had learned and reviewed every line and section and statute of Colorado voting law, which Whitmire had clearly just violated. Suddenly, Carol Whitmire panicked. He admitted it. He'd hired Jim Bromley and brought him to Aspen to investigate recent incidents in town. From a hitchhiker and an ambulance driver, he'd heard about a suspicious plot involving the town's dynamite supply. And he'd also been told by his informants in the Colorado Bureau of Investigation that federal fugitive Catherine Ann Power, a wanted member of the radical Weatherman faction of Students for a Democratic Society, SDS, was hiding in the area. He swore that he never gave the order for Thompson to be contacted directly, but he did admit that he'd known about Bromley's Saturday visit to the Jerome, which he discussed afterward with his campaign manager. Thompson turned to the assistant district attorney. "This is felony conspiracy," he said. But the DA's office refused to get involved. Later that day, APD officer Rick Crabtree received a phone call from the manager at the Applejack Inn. A maid had just found a terrifying-looking sawed-off shotgun in the room of one of their guests, a certain James Bromley, who'd been staying with them since Saturday. Crabtree drove down Main Street, and from Bromley's empty room, he confiscated for the second time in 2 days the illegal weapon. Thompson called the DA and told him that things had gone too far. Certain members of his campaign were so fed up, they were rallying together at that very moment to storm the Applejack Hotel and make a citizen's arrest. A half hour later, Bromley snuck onto the impound lot and, without filing any paperwork, retrieved his car. That night, he drove back to Boulder, but not before he'd apparently found the time to raid the Ski Corporation's dynamite hold. In place of the stolen case of explosives, he'd left a note. "This will only be used on Hunter Thompson if he is elected sheriff. SDS. Only a cop's brain could have churned up that mix of silly bullshit, Thompson would write afterward. "And although we never doubted that, we also understood that the same warped mentality might also be capable of running that kind of twisted act all the way out to its brutally illogical extreme." On Wednesday night, with the election less than a week away, Thompson sent Sandy and Juan to stay at Michael Solheim's house, and with a half dozen friends, he set up patrols on the grounds of Owl Farm, each of them armed to the teeth. He knew that people like J. Sterling Baxter had millions of dollars in future developments and investments riding on the outcome of the election, and that they were willing to do anything to protect and preserve, in Thompson's words, all their foul hopes and greedy fascist dreams. For Carol Whitmire, the stakes were just as high. If he lost the election, he'd also lose his family's sole source of income and his place of residence. With his eight children and wife, he'd be forced to move out of the county courthouse basement in which he'd lived for the last 4 years. The next day, the Aspen Times published a detailed account of the whole Bromley affair. "Towed Car Reveals Election Scandal," the article was titled, along with the sidebar, "Case of Dynamite Stolen Recently from Ski Corp." The editorial board endorsed Thompson. "We cannot condone the flagrant disregard for the democratic process that the presence of an informant agent provocateur in his political opponent's headquarters demonstrates." The following evening, Thompson opened his mail to find a Polaroid photograph. It pictured James Bromley, a self-portrait. In it, Bromley was posing in front of an enormous Nazi flag. A poster in the background depicted a maniacally grinning skeleton. "God is dead," this poster declared. The skeleton was wearing Nazi headgear. In each hand, it appeared to be holding a long-nosed revolver. Bromley, sitting just to the left of the flag, had on sunglasses and a Nazi officer's visor. A swastika pendant the size of a milk saucer hung from a chain around his neck. "To Hunter Thompson, from Jim," he'd written on the back of the photo. "See you soon." That autumn, Rolling Stone, a biweekly San Francisco music magazine published by then 24-year-old Jan Wenner, featured Hunter Thompson's work for the first time. "The Battle of Aspen," an account of the Joe Edwards mayoral campaign that also included passages of political speculation on the nature of small-town politics. "An underground candidate who really wanted to win," Thompson wrote, "could assume from the start a working nut of about 40% of the electorate, with his chances of victory riding almost entirely on the backlash potential." His opponents took note. The weekend before the election, after failing in a variety of ways to head off the freak power ticket, the town's two major parties made a deal. The Democrats would drop out of the county commissioner race, giving the edge to J. Sterling Baxter over Ned Vare, and Republican Glenn Ricks would concede the sheriff's race, transferring his voters to Whitmire. A subsequent telephone-slash-chain-letter campaign managed to contact every single resident in town multiple times. One man reported receiving more than a dozen calls. On election night, to the packed crowd at the Jerome Hotel, which included reporters for national newspapers and from magazines like Life, Harper's, and Look, as well as two documentary film crews, the results went from bad to worse. In the end, Thompson lost to Whitmire 1,533 to 1,065, and Vare went down to Baxter by a margin of 197 votes. For his concession speech, Hunter Thompson, an American flag draped over his shoulders and a blonde wig, cocked awkwardly on his scalp, announced, "Ladies and gentlemen, this is my last press conference. You won't have Hunter Thompson to kick around anymore." In truth, he was relieved. He was a writer, a political one, but still an artist, not a rural county sheriff. In the wake of Chicago, he'd fought back, and it gave him hope. "It might still be possible to alter the fascist drift of this nation," he wrote afterward, "without burning it down in the process." In Aspen, the changes he'd fought for were already beginning to take hold. The recent election had been a countywide affair, but they'd won the city itself by a large margin. In the 1972 elections, they'd finally take over the city and county governing councils with CCA representatives Ned Vair and Joe Edwards. And a few years after that, Carol Whitmire, caught red-handed redirecting funds for personal benefit, would resign in disgrace. That autumn, Thompson, reflecting on where he'd been and what he might do next, wrote to his aunt in Louisville, "The net result of this last incredible campaign seems to be that I'm now plunged heavily into national politics. But on some very odd level that doesn't seem to fit with anybody's idea of left or right or center or anything else. And that's just about the way it should be, I think." Chapter 5. Some Dreamers of the Golden Dream. 1971. The Pink Palace. On Friday, March 19, 1971, Hunter Thompson climbed into his rental car, a Ford Pinto, and drove west on Whittier Boulevard. He was headed to Oscar Acosta's place, which was located near the Ramona Gardens housing project, about 4 miles away. For the past week, he'd been staying at a boarding house in East Los Angeles to report on the Chicano movement for Rolling Stone. It was early afternoon. Across the four-lane street, only a few thin bars of shade remained, the smog brightening the sky. He passed beneath the Long Beach freeway. Suddenly, on his left was Laguna Park, a grassy expanse of softball fields and picnic tables that, 6 months earlier, during a 20,000-person march organized by the National Chicano Moratorium Committee to protest the Vietnam War, had been the site of a deadly police riot. Driving by it, he would have been hard-pressed to look in the direction of its chain-link backstops without picturing, if only for a moment, the same widespread violence sparking up again. In the last year, Whittier Boulevard had been the scene of upheaval, violent conflagrations that descended as if from a ridge to engulf the surrounding neighborhood. The way things were going now, all it would take was another protest followed by a rock or two, and the police response would materialize in a way Thompson knew all too well. The volleys of tear gas, great billows of it, and then a mass of people desperately fleeing the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, its officers advancing like an ancient phalanx down the full breadth of the avenue. Cautiously, meticulously, side by side in white helmets and khaki shirts, the gas masks distorting their faces. That was exactly how things had played out during the August 29, 1970 Chicano moratorium demonstration in East L.A., a Chicago-style police riot that had left 3 people dead and caused millions of dollars in damages. The temperature was in the low 60s. The sun was a high, bright pain in the smog. Thompson steered the Pinto in his usual fashion, with skill and nerve, accelerating into the spaces between his car and the next as block after block of Whittier Boulevard slid past. He'd spent the past week alongside Acosta in the company of the Brown Berets, who'd made it a point to let Thompson know they didn't trust him. And why should they? The movement then was rife with suspicion and dissent. Anyone who wasn't from East Los Angeles was seen as an outsider. The night before, Thompson had been hanging back in the kitchen of Acosta's place near Ramona Gardens when, from the other room, he'd heard someone shout, "What the hell is this goddamn gabacho pig rider doing here? Are we fucking crazy to be letting him hear all this shit?
Jesus, he's heard enough to put every one of us away for 5 years.
Longer than that, was Thompson's first thought. In his presence, the Brown Berets had repeatedly talked about combating police brutality with organized violence of their own, and throughout the week they'd suggested that it would be in his best interest to stay away altogether. On his previous trips to East L.A., there'd been moments of tension and awkwardness, but nothing like this. Now there was no way around it. He was a stranger who didn't belong. Thompson had been considering writing an article on the movement since 1968, but the catalyst to his current trip was the murder, during the August 29th moratorium march, of the Mexican-American journalist Ruben Salazar, a brilliant, well-known columnist and television host who, at the time of his death, also happened to be Los Angeles law enforcement's most prominent critic. 6 months earlier, on that hot afternoon in August, Salazar had been covering the rally when the police, on the pretense of responding to an alleged theft at a local corner store, declared the crowd of 20,000 in Laguna Park an unlawful gathering and moved in to clear it. They'd attacked with tear gas and clubs, striking children and elderly family members and anyone else who'd been sitting on the grass and listening to the notable roster of speakers, which included Rodolfo Corky Gonzalez, a poet and former boxer who'd founded the Denver-based Crusade for Justice. Desperately, the protesters had fled eastward toward Whittier Boulevard, and in an attempt to stay ahead of the violence, Ruben Salazar and a colleague ducked into the Silver Dollar Lounge, a yellow tavern with a red curtained entrance located at 4045 Whittier. Together, they were sitting at the bar hoping to wait things out, when, unbeknownst to them, a team of sheriff's deputies acting on what they'd later claimed to be an anonymous tip surrounded the Silver Dollar and sealed off the premises, and then proceeded to fire high-powered canisters of tear gas through the curtained entrance. One struck Salazar in the temple, killing him instantly. Thompson's current article was centered on the question everyone in East L.A. had been asking. Was Salazar assassinated? The answer, he knew, could represent an irreversible escalation. "When the cops declare open season on journalists," he'd write, "when they feel free to declare any scene of unlawful protest a free fire zone, that will be a very ugly day, and not just for journalists." But was that actually the case? If Salazar had been the target of a high-level conspiracy to silence dissent, where was the evidence? "It was difficult even for me to believe that the cops had killed him deliberately," he'd explain. "I knew they were capable of it, but I was not quite ready to believe they had actually done it. Because once I believed that, I also had to accept the idea that they were prepared to kill anybody who seemed to be annoying them, even me." All week, he'd been trying to get to the bottom of it. He'd stayed up until dawn, drinking with Acosta and the movement's leaders. He'd interviewed sheriff's deputies and spokesmen. He'd forced himself to read through the 2,025-page coroner's inquest into Salazar's death. He'd walked up and down Whittier Boulevard as the conversations around him switched immediately to Spanish. No one on either side trusted him. What Thompson needed was perspective. The context to arrange Ruben Salazar's death within the broader narrative of the Chicano movement and rampant police brutality. By Friday, he was seriously considering giving up on the piece, which would have been a disastrous development. In the last few months, he'd found himself in terrible credit card debt after Warren Hinkle's magazine, Scanlan's, had gone bankrupt before it could pay his fees and reimburse him for his expenses from multiple assignments, $5,000 worth. And as a result, his American Express and Diners Club accounts had been frozen. He was worried his carte blanche card would be next. He'd just received a final notice before seizure letter from the IRS stating that he owed $3,000 in back taxes. He still hadn't sent Jim Silberman a coherent draft of the Death of the American Dream book. It would need a much more drastic restructuring than he'd initially realized. And he couldn't count on Random House for immediate cash. he had to get this article done for Rolling Stone. Jan Wenner liked his work, and already there'd been talk about a possible staff writer gig, which would mean a steady paycheck. But he was running out of time, in more ways than one. After a week of hardly any sleep, of all-night drinking bouts with Acosta and the Brown Berets, and frightening daytime interactions with police officials, his dexedrine usage, which in the face of such constant danger had increased to previously uncharted levels, was beginning to double back on him, a rebound effect of panic and fear that was amplified with each new pill he swallowed. At this point, the ups and downs were physical. When the drug wore off, he could feel its passage, receding like a tide from the blue depths of his veins. Which would perhaps help to explain why he was willing to go out on a limb now and show up unannounced at Acosta's place, a last-ditch attempt to secure the information on which his article depended. He turned right on Soto Street, headed north. At a small bungalow, he pulled over and parked. Then he walked up to Acosta's porch and knocked loudly on the door. A shadow across the tiny eye window. Voices beyond. In the next moment, he stepped into a mid-sized living room filled with a dozen young members of the East Los Angeles Brown Berets. During the recent riots, a 15-year-old Brown Beret had been shot and killed by law enforcement. Others were currently on trial for arson, accused, falsely, of starting fires on the upper floors of the Biltmore Hotel during a 1969 speech by Governor Ronald Reagan. Together, these young militants had christened Acosta's house El Pueblo and declared it an independent territory from the city and its police. In their possession, they had guns and knives, as well as a substantial amount of gasoline, soap, and oil, the necessary ingredients for a large cache of homemade firebombs. Thompson stepped around them. He needed to see his friend. Oscar Acosta was standing near the kitchen, and with everyone else, he watched this gabacho reporter walk toward him, alone and unannounced. It had been 6 months since Thompson had last visited Southern California, a period in which the political atmosphere of East Los Angeles had changed dramatically. Now, whenever Acosta went anywhere, he was accompanied without fail by his three bodyguards. At all times, he kept at his side a leather attaché case, packed with blank legal pads, an enormous amount of marijuana, a .357 Magnum Colt Python handgun, and a box of bullets. Lately, he'd been saying things like, "How long do they expect us to keep coming down to their goddamn courthouse and begging for justice?" And, "This legal bullshit ain't making it." And, "The day of blood will come." The FBI opened multiple files on him. LA law enforcement kept this house and his activities under near constant surveillance. In court that week, Acosta was representing Corky Gonzalez. During the August 29th police riot, Gonzalez had fled with family and friends alongside thousands of others once the cops descended, was pursued by helicopter, pulled over, and arrested on trumped-up charges of robbery and weapons possession. Acosta had also set into motion his legal assault on the grand jury selection system. Representing the Brown Berets accused of arson, the Biltmore Six, as they'd become known, he'd subpoenaed and under oath interrogated every single Los Angeles County Superior Court judge, 109 in all, as to the logic by which they chose their candidates for the grand juries. The blowback had been enormous. By both friends and enemies alike, he'd been told repeatedly that he'd crossed the line. Did he really expect to get away with humiliating the most powerful figures in Los Angeles? That afternoon, Thompson didn't plan on staying. Instead, he asked Acosta to join him for a moment on the porch. At El Pueblo, he and Acosta were never alone, surrounded, as always, by teenage militants. And over the past week, they hadn't had a single moment to speak privately. Finally, the young militants were out of earshot. Acosta was still accompanied by his three bodyguards, but Thompson knew these men well enough to understand that their uneasiness at his presence had less to do with revolutionary ideology than common sense. A story in Rolling Stone might put added pressure on the LA Sheriff's Department and highlight the issue of Chicano rights to a national audience, but other activists would see Acosta's cooperation as grandstanding, selling out. And besides, the movement had already tried the journalism route, and the only thing that came out of it, in their opinion, was a tear gas canister to Salazar's head. In other words, the article was all risk and no reward, and they were worried for Acosta's safety. The front yard was dusty and dry. In its lack of shade, everything seemed to shine at once, a blinding, saturated light. Acosta was within a few feet of the rented Pinto. It was the moment Thompson had driven to the house to engineer. "I can't stand it anymore," he finally said. "I can't even talk to you." They needed to speak together privately, he suggested, now. He asked his friend to get in the car with him. All week, Acosta had been on edge. He hadn't had a quiet moment in ages. He was tired of looking over his shoulder. In the last few months, he'd become convinced that the police were out to silence him in the same way they silenced Salazar, who on the whole was far less oppositional. How many of the young militants were in reality paid informants for the sheriff's department? How long would it be until deputies appeared in the middle of the night and fired tear gas canisters at point-blank range through the windows and walls of El Pueblo's crowded living room? "The cops never lose," he'd recently told Thompson. "I think maybe the real shit is about to come down." It could happen at any time. And perhaps this was why, in the next instant, without further discussion, Acosta followed Thompson to the street and climbed into the Pinto's front seat. There was nothing that the bodyguards could do. He'd made the decision himself. Together, they drove across the viaduct and merged onto the Hollywood freeway, heading for the hills beyond. Thompson already had a destination in mind. In 1971, the Polo Lounge at the Beverly Hills Hotel was the ideal place to enjoy a few quiet afternoon drinks. Throughout its terraced patio, beneath its great sun-struck canopy, there was enough shade and obscurity to last a lifetime. At a price, of course. This was the same venue that Mia Farrow had supposedly been banned from for having the gall to arrive in a pair of slacks. Zsa Zsa Gabor signed her first movie contract here. Joan Didion, a frequent lunchtime guest, lived just up the road. And the patio had recently become the preferred meeting place on Western Swings for high-ranking officials in the Nixon administration's committee to re-elect the president. With its bougainvillea and trellises and arid pools of shade, the Polo Lounge was West Coast elegance at its best, a secluded refuge for the rich and famous that was far less likely to subject its patrons to the degree of public scrutiny they'd come to expect elsewhere. On the patio, they were shown a table near the palm trees. They ordered gin cocktails, Singapore slings, with mezcal on the side. They ordered coffee. They ordered beer and extra ice. Rolling Stone would cover the expenses, Thompson insisted, once the article was finished. After a while, a grand piano struck up. The wind caught in the high green sails of the palms. Along the flowered terraces of the patio section, the sense of privacy was immense. No one at the Polo Lounge wanted to be overheard. It's why people came here, to do business. And while it would have been abundantly clear to anyone looking on that Hunter Thompson and Oscar Acosta were not what you'd expect in the usual Friday afternoon crowd at the Beverly Hills Hotel, they'd managed to take advantage of the seclusion that the Hollywood scene, itself eccentric, demanded. At last, Thompson could talk privately with Acosta about Salazar's death. "I'm starting to get a bit wiggy from all this pressure," he admitted. He explained how difficult things had been this past week in East LA, caught between the brown berets and the police. It was like standing on stage all the time, like finding yourself in the middle of a prison riot. It had been impossible to tell who was lying and who was telling the truth. From every direction, the weasels were closing in. Acosta drank and listened. No doubt he'd already thought up rebuttals to his friend's complaints, to these metaphors that betrayed the blind spots of Thompson's position. After all, a stage actor gets to go home once the performance is done. In a prison riot, it's the interlopers, the guards, who find their freedom revoked. How could someone who spends all his time in an alpine valley possibly understand what it was like to live under the threats of L.A. law enforcement, let alone imagine, in the face of such odds, the courage it takes to fight back? Besides, what precisely did he mean by weasels? But Acosta could also see Thompson's general point. The article was something they'd settled on together out of mutual trust and respect to expose the corruption and brutality of the Los Angeles police and sheriff's departments to a larger audience. And by refusing to talk about the Salazar case honestly with Thompson this past week, he'd gone back on his word, the one currency that had sustained their relationship from the beginning. "I agree," Acosta finally replied. He explained that the real problem was El Pueblo, his leadership status there, which as of late had made it impossible for them to be seen as friends. A year earlier, running for L.A. County Sheriff in the summer of 1970, Oscar Acosta's political battles in East Los Angeles had still included a recognizable approach. Of course, he never expected to win the election, and from the start, the whole thing had been a publicity stunt, a way for him to get his voice heard. But he'd been willing to work within the existing system to achieve this publicity. And in the end, the campaign had brought him an enormous amount of attention. Celebrities like Anthony Quinn came out to support him. He did television and radio interviews and was featured prominently in the Los Angeles Times. More than 100,000 residents had cast their votes for him. But in the process, he'd also drawn the undivided attention of one of post-war America's most formidable institutions, Los Angeles law enforcement, at the height of its 20th century glory.